The Athletic.
Totally Football Show today. Manchester Derby. Man United crumble. Haaland blowing past people like he's Philip Schofield. We'll get the reaction. North London Derby 2. Second time in a month that a game's been disrupted by a royal send-off. Wolves dismissal. Go large and go home. Club tell manager. But after Nuno and Bruno, who now for the Midlands side? We've got all the news and the best views on a remarkable round 9 of the season in this Totally Football Show. October 3rd, 2022. Listener, thank you so much for joining us today. We've got a lot of Premier League to talk about, but of course, our thoughts with everyone affected by the stadium tragedy, the really terrible news of what happened in Indonesia at the football game there this weekend. Over 100 dead and many, many more injured. Just a horrible, horrible disaster there. Now we have with us today Daniel Storey, Adrian Clark, and Tim Spears. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Hey, guys.
Morning, James.
Morning to you. Morning to you. It's game week 9 of the season. My word. 9 games so far, 32 goals, 9 of them in one match. The Manchester Derby, which finished 6-3 for Man City, with hat tricks for Phil Foden and Erling Haaland. Meanwhile, the weekend's other big derby saw Arsenal beating Spurs 3-1 to stay a point clear of Man City at the top of the table. Elsewhere in the Premier League, there were good starts for two new managers. Graham Potter's Chelsea won 2-1 at Palace to go fifth, a point off the top four. While Liverpool welcomed Roberto De Zerbi to the Premier League, promptly went 2-0 down to his Brighton before rallying to end up drawing 3-3. Newcastle got their second win of the campaign, 4-1 against 10-man Fulham. Everton also got their second win. That was a come-from-behind effort at Saints and 2-1 that finish. There were no goals between Bournemouth and Brentford or Leeds and Villa, while a 2-0 win for West Ham against Wolves saw the Midland side parting company with manager Bruno Lage. Excellent. Quick sting. Then let's get into the Manchester Derby.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Can he reach it? You bet he can. You bet he can. Gomez, fast and low. Hat-trick, hat-trick, hat-trick.
All right, Man City 6, Man United 3. Tim, you were there at the Etihad for the highest scoring Manchester derby of all time.
And they wanted more. They wanted 10. They were saying they wanted 10 after the third goal around by me. I was in with the fans, with the Man City fans, doing a piece on derbies this weekend. I was at Arsenal Spurs and I'm going to Leicester Forest tonight. Not the proper derby experience, so that I'm not hungover and I didn't get arrested. But it's been a pretty...
Did you punch a horse, perhaps?
I tried. It's too quick for me. But it's been a pretty incredible weekend. 13 goals in two games and the big one still to come tonight.
Right. Well, yeah, and two hat-tricks in this one at the Etihad. I mean, the world is awash with the Erling Haaland stats, and we'll get onto all that madness in a second. But a quick word for Phil Foden. My word, he's really coming alive.
Yeah, and I don't think he had been so far this season, really. He's sort of very similar to Jack Grealish in that it feels like they're maybe not quite fully fit or not quite clicking. If it was going to click for a Manchester City attacking midfielder, it helps to play a defence that is prepared to have four of them standing within 5 yards of each other, three of them claiming for an offside that isn't valid, while Foden just sort of dances through and asks if anyone's noticed him. It was embarrassing, the space he got. The finish for the first goal, I thought, kind of summed up City's performance, because everything looks so easy, and yet you watch one slow motion replay and you just realise how kind of exacting and, you know, almost like scientific everything they do is, and yet still beautiful, because it was a gorgeous finish with his left foot.
Adrian, you're nodding. Did you want to add some Foden feels?
Oh, I'm a big fan of Phil Foden. No, I just thinking about the defending there, and it just felt like it was more like Mannequin United than Manchester United. In that first half, though, they were so static, and they were all standing in the wrong positions anyway. So this was a major problem. And I don't want to take too much away from Manchester City because they were scintillating. They're a sensational team and they brought their A game. But this was an absolutely dreadful Manchester United first half performance. They just had no bottle, no real belief. Didn't look like they had any tactical organisation. And that central spine where Phil Foden made hay, running off Eriksen for the first goal and others for the others. But it was just remarkable how empty it was. I just couldn't quite get my head around it.
Adrian, talking about that central spine there, my favourite bits of the game, or the bits that made me kind of laugh involuntarily, weren't the goals. It was Manuel Akanji and Nathan Ake kind of picking up the ball and then just sort of realising there was 40 yards of space for them to not even run, just sort of saunter forward with the ball and then eventually pick a pass about 40 yards from goal. It was as if Manchester United were playing no central midfielders. I can't believe he didn't pick Casemiro, given this is presumably exactly what he was signed for. But there was just no movement from McTominay. I mean, McTominay was dreadful. He wasn't really helped by Christian Eriksen, but he was the worst, the kind of most guilty party, I think. But just no pressure on the ball at any point.
We'll come on to Ten Hag's decisions in a second or two, but let's just round up the Erling Haaland numbers, because he really is, you called it scientific, he's science fiction. Haaland is the first player in Premier League history to score hat-tricks in three successive home games. Haaland now has as many Premier League hat-tricks as Ronaldo, Vardy and Lampard in eight games. Put that in perspective, Michael Owen took 48 matches to reach three Premier League hat-tricks, and that was the fastest ever. Ruud van Nistelrooy done it in 59. Luis Suarez took 71. Erling Haaland has done it in eight. On his own, he's outscored this season Man United 17 goals to 11. He scored a goal every 13.6 touches, and he got two assists in his game. Extraordinary. Mark Watson online japing. Haaland should go to the World Cup. And every team is allowed to summon him once in the tournament for 30 minutes. He arrives by parachute. We'll work on the logistics when we have this approved. I mean, I like that. A shout out to Czech's notes. Scott Parker's Bournemouth, who remain the only club in all competitions this season to stop Haaland scoring, for the benefit of Copenhagen, who face them Wednesday in the Champions League, and then Saints next weekend, or indeed Liverpool the weekend after that. What do you do against Haaland in this city?
This passive approach that Man United had clearly just was not the answer. I had a fantastic view of City's movement. I was the second from back row of the third tier. So it was a bit like watching a game of sensible soccer. But it was really interesting to watch Foden, Grealish, De Bruyne and Haaland in particular. But even from that incredibly high vantage point, Haaland's legs really, really stuck out. I mean, they are meaty thighs that could crush walnuts. And I don't know. I just felt like United were just mesmerised by him and by City, because they weren't leaving huge gaps necessarily, but they were just so passive. It just sort of played into City's hands. As good as they were, it just played into City's hands. And also with the formation as well. I was just going to say my good friend Paul, who's a diehard Man United fan from Surrey, saw the starting 11 and messaged me at 1 p.m. and said, starting one DM versus City, Erik ten Hag confirmed as psychotic. I think we'll lose 7-3. So he was only one goal out.
I think history shows that you can't really try and take on City at their own game unless you are yourselves an elite opponent. You can't be passive, which is what Manchester United were. I think the only way to try and... It's not about beating them, it's about them making them doubt themselves. And when they doubt themselves, you can kind of expose those mental flaws. But I think the only way to really do that is through kind of outright physicality. That's what I think Real Madrid have tried to do before, just sort of hustle them. And that's hard this season for two reasons. Partly because the season schedule is so relentless that you've probably got another game in 3 or 4 days, and managers will think, well, that's not necessarily going to work. So why should we expend all this energy trying to, you know, maybe only lose by one or two goals or maybe get a draw against City if we've got a more winnable game coming up? And also because of Haaland, because he is this physical beast, central defenders cannot do that to him. You can maybe hassle them in midfield, but then further up the pitch, they'll still bully you anyway. So that looks like an impossible plan as well. I think the only answer is to hope that they're not on their A game, because there are occasions when that happens. And, you know, Newcastle exploited that, for example, partway through a game, you can just sense that they're not quite on it. But if they are on it, it's an impossibility, I think, for most teams in the Premier League.
I make you right, Daniel. I do. I think physicality is the only way to really stop Manchester City potentially. It's putting enough pressure on them so that final ball into Haaland from De Bruyne or Silva or any of the other guys is affected by what you do, and it's just slightly off. That's the only way I can think that they might be troubled this season. I mean, on Haaland, it's timing, isn't it? I think his timing is precocious. I think it's borderline genius, actually. Something you can't begin to coach. Just look at that, the way that he got on the end of that De Bruyne cross. Just every aspect of it from a timing point of view was just sensational, wasn't it? The way that he ghosted off the back of the defender, the timing of the slide, getting those studs out at the right moment to meet the ball. It took my breath away, really. And you can even look at his assist, the one for Foden where he just slides it across goal, the timing of that. Again, just perfection. It's remarkable, isn't it, that a lot of people, and a lot of very clever football people were wondering, could he handle the Premier League? And it just all sounds so silly now, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, let's move on from that quickly. Let's talk about United. Daniel says, I don't blame a single United supporter who filed out early. Daniel, even though they missed them beating City 3-2 in the second half.
Yeah, even that. I don't, because you can accept your team playing badly and you can accept your team being outclassed. And Manchester United are at a level at the moment where if City play their best, they will win comfortably. But the attitude of kind of as a collective in defence and of certain players as well. I thought Bruno Fernandes was an embarrassment, to be honest, yesterday. He's either moaning at the referee while running or moaning at the referee while stood still or moaning at a teammate for overhitting a pass, probably a minute after he's overhit a pass. I thought the only player who came out of it with really any credit, or certainly of the starters, was Antony, and he's only been there 5 minutes. He was the only one that looked visibly annoyed by what was happening rather than just broken. Everyone else, even Raphael Varane, just looked broken. Whereas he just looked kind of put out by it, as if to say, we need to actually try and do something here. And he did, and his goal was brilliant.
What did you make of Ten Hag's explanation for not using Cristiano Ronaldo, sparing him the embarrassment of being involved in such a game, such a performance? I'm hearing your reaction.
The only thing that in Manchester United's favour is they didn't score a calamitous own goal. And then Erik ten Hag sort of after the match thought, well, hold your horses. I am prepared to score a spectacular own goal here. I mean, he was always going to get that question because Ronaldo didn't come on. He should have known that was coming. And he should have known there's a very easy deflection, which is just the state of the game meant I didn't think it justified it.
Or the fact that Martial scored two goals.
Exactly.
He presumably came on in his place.
Exactly.
Do you think it was a big mistake? Should Ronaldo have come on?
No, I don't. I think he's past use for Manchester United. But especially in this system. But there are ways and means of not extending that story onto Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday.
What would you have him at the club for, having said that he was still part of your plans, if not given his pass to bring on when you're 4-0 down anyway?
Yeah, I wouldn't have him at the club anymore. I mean, I know it's not as simple as that, and I know they struggled to shift him, and he struggled to shift himself, and therefore Ten Hag was left. He gave the right answer at that point, which is while he's here, he will be a valuable member of the squad, yada yada.
Right.
But yeah, I don't think there is any purpose for him in that club anymore.
I was going to say the fans leaving at half time. They were actually really sort of defiant at 2-0. In fact, they were the only ones singing for a large period of the first half. But then after the fourth went in, and it was nice hearing the pitch of the noise of the celebrations getting higher as the goals went in 3, 4, and 5. I always enjoy that at a football game. But at 4-0, the City fans were basically saying, why the F are you still here? That was the chant. And then I think a lot of them just decided to go home. And then the day was summed up for me when I was leaving the stadium about an hour after full time. There were two Man United fans walking past me out the ground in their red shirts, and a car slowed down in the road. Someone wound down their window, started cackling like a hyena, just laughed at these two Man United fans, and then rolled the window up and just drove off. I've never seen anything like it. But they didn't even react, these two poor guys. They just carried on walking straight face.
Oh dear. Wow. Well, one thing that Ten Hag could have said about Ronaldo is that he was keeping him fresh for Thursday night's action when he might get a run out against Omonia Nicosia in the Europa League. He'll enjoy that. 3 days later, United will be at Goodison Park to face Everton. That'll be an interesting game. They are 9 points off the top as it stands. 1 point off the top, meanwhile, are Manchester City, because good as they are, there is one side who are 1 point better off than them, and that team is an Arsenal team.
The only way to score is, of course, to play with a handbrake off.
Hello, I'm Ian Stone, host of Handbrake Off, the twice-weekly Arsenal podcast brought to you by The Athletic. Each week, I'm joined by two of Amy Lawrence, Adrian Clark, Art de Roche and James McNicholas. What a lineup that is, to talk about the best club in the Premier League. This week, join us to bask in the North London Derby glory. And let me tell you, do we bask? Yes, we do. Come back later in the week on Friday as we look ahead to another massive tussle with Liverpool and look to keep the number one firmly by our name. Search for Handbrake Off now, available wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, if you could hit follow to make sure you keep up with the best team. That's us, covering the best team. That is Handbrake Off. So good, we made it twice.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Catch all new episodes Thursdays on FX. Stream on Hulu. On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is the Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Martinelli and Granit Xhaka! A crowd of Gunners euphoria!
Arsenal 3, Tottenham 1. Tim, blimey, you were at this one too. And Daniel and Adrian, ooh, I think, as well, yeah?
Full house, yeah.
Yeah, to watch Spurs' 13-game unbeaten run in the Premier League coming to an end in an abject manner. Is that fair?
Certainly the last sort of 20 minutes felt a bit humiliating for Spurs, really. I counted five standing ovations for Arsenal players as the Tottenham fans drifted out.
Was there cackling?
Didn't hear any cackling. Although the sort of very empty away end reminded me of that of the famous 4-4 draw a few years ago, and I was thinking, hang on, it's only three. They didn't look like making a comeback, but you know, if I was a Spurs fan, I'd have remembered that day and maybe hung around. But no, it was a pretty miserable second half, and I think a lot of Spurs fans were expecting defeat, but probably not in that manner. It was a shame from Spurs' point of view that it was just individual mistakes that cost them a shot at a point. I know there are a lot of Tottenham fans frustrated with how they approached the game anyway, but they were in a decent position at half-time and they looked like they were troubling Arsenal through the centre, you know, on the counter-attack. But that Lloris clanger and then a really daft red card and it's game over within, 13 minutes of the second half?
Arsenal taking the lead with a magnificent strike from Thomas Partey. Kane equalising before half-time with the penalty, then that Jesus goal, then the red card, and then Granit Xhaka. Adrian, Granit Xhaka has scored as many goals in the Premier League this season as Mo Salah. What's going on?
Love that stat. I absolutely love it. Yeah, from revulsion to reverence, Granit Xhaka. I mean, they love him now. They absolutely adore him. And I couldn't be more happy for him, because he did have to endure a fair bit of stick. And, you know, for all of those years, really, the Arsenal fans didn't take to him. He was a figure that they liked to blame. And he didn't help himself with a lot of rash decisions and bad tackles and red cards and whatnot. But yeah, he's loving it at the moment. And this new role does suit him. You have to say that.
What
the
is
previous
the new role?
Managers. Well, basically, it's the system now is very much a 4-1-4-1. Which leaves Thomas Partey as the sole defensive midfielder. But when Arsenal have the ball, Zinchenko effectively becomes a central midfielder. So it's 3-2. and then there's a five. And Granit Xhaka is part of that front five now. And he's given license to cause a little bit of chaos, to make runs off of opposite number midfield players like he did in this game, and to interchange with Martinelli at times, with Zinchenko. It's a very fluid role, but it basically, in layman's terms, gets him 20 or 30 yards higher up the pitch where those incisive passes can make more of a difference. And he's, because he's not needed as a defensive player anymore, because there are five better defenders behind him. He's not needed as a progressive passer from left back, because the whole back four now are all excellent progressive passers. So you can just cut him loose a little bit. And yeah, he had five touches inside the box in this game, obviously one of them for the goal. Harry Kane had two. So, you know, that stands out. I mean, looking at it across the board, I think touches inside the opposition box is quite relevant in this fixture, because it signals the difference in approaches. Arsenal were kind of attack, attack, attack. Spurs were very much sit in and we'll break, and that's it. Between them, Kane, Richarlison and Son had seven touches inside the Arsenal box. Martinelli had eight, Saka had eight, and Jesus had 13, which equated to the total number of touches by Spurs players in the whole game. So if I'm Kane, Richarlison and Son, I'm a little bit frustrated that I'm not getting more touches of the ball in the areas that matter. So that's something, I think, for Antonio Conte to consider moving forwards. But yeah, this match was about Arsenal and the development they've made. It was really, really good fun, I've got to say, to watch it unfold. I just thought, in a high pressure, high stakes game, considering what happened and how they crumbled last season in those big matches, I thought it was brilliant to see the confidence and the positivity in their football. Yeah, it was glorious.
The most impressive thing for me is a neutral watching it as an observer of the Premier League, is it's amazing how quickly that this Arsenal team have gone from, this is a very young team that we need to have a lot of patience in, to, hang on a minute, this is an Arsenal team who are top of the Premier League and nobody's really talking about the age. You look at the age of the squad, you've got Partey and Xhaka in central midfield who are 29 and 30 and are kind of the senior players in that team. There's no one else who's older than 25. And the only two that were 25 are Zinchenko and Jesus, who are the two new players and have settled in really quickly. Around them, you've got everybody is between 21 and 23 years old. And that is not just really impressive and not just the kind of the embodiment of this new Arsenal era. It's also pretty obviously sustainable over a long period of time, because I think they will get better.
How old is William Saliba?
He's still 21. And
what?
This is what I mean. They've got players in that team almost across the board who have got a huge amount of experience. Not all successful experience, but a huge amount of experience. They've gone through things. So Martin Odegaard had the big move that didn't work out and he's moved on. Bukayo Saka had, you know, the experience of the Euros final and has moved on. You've got Saliba, who's moved to Arsenal, didn't work out initially, was sent out on loan, has come back and looks brilliant. You've got Gabriel Martinelli, who wanted to be this kind of centre forward and now looks like an elite, you know, left-sided wide forward or winger. There's so many players in there who look mature, who look old for their age, and that's exactly what Mikel Arteta wanted.
Yeah, I think in life, it doesn't really start until you've taken a big old punch in the face sometimes. In metaphorical terms, because it's how you get better, isn't it? You learn from a disappointment, from something bad, something rubbish
school
that happens
of hard
to you.
Knocks.
Yeah, exactly. And Daniel is absolutely right to pick up on that, because I think it's a driving force within the group. They've all got this collective sort of experience. The ones that were there last year had the experience of blowing it big time and taking their medicine. And then the other players have all had these hard knocks too. I think it's a real motivating factor. And it is driving them on at the moment. There'll be bumps in the road again. But yeah, they've just got to enjoy this momentum. It's fantastic.
You mentioned the drive and also the confidence, Adrian. I mean, this is my first North London derby. I've got to say, I wasn't expecting the intensity, particularly for a 12:30 kickoff. It was remarkable. But it was my second visit to the Emirates this year. The other was for them when they beat Wolves in the last minute in February. The noise that night was astonishing. It was one of the loudest noises I've heard at a stadium in many years. And I didn't think it'd be topped, really, but it was. I think Arteta said it was the best atmosphere he's ever experienced at the Emirates on Saturday. I've got to say, pre-match, I was mingling with the Arsenal fans for this piece I'm writing about derbies. I've never seen ever, yes, I'm going to say that this is probably because I've been mostly watching Wolves for 30 years. I've never seen fans so happy before a game. I was hanging around on Gillespie Road and everyone's sort of drinking in the sunshine out there. Everybody I was looking at was happy, smiling, cracking jokes. It was unbelievably relaxed, you know, like an hour before a derby. It was quite disgusting, really. I was like, yeah, it was horrible. I was like, do you not know? But they did seem like genuine football fans. It wasn't just tourists. It was disgusting. But you know, fair play.
Arsenal, at what point do we,
I don't think
32 games.
Their answer, and it's a very much a stock answer, but I think it's probably also the right one, is that because of the age of the team, you don't do any of that. You know, they will obviously have targets within the dressing room, but Aaron Ramsdale talked after the game and he kind of made a joke about the fact that he was going to say take each game as it comes because he knows it's a cliche, but he was kind of intimating, well, that's what we're going on now. We've generated this momentum, so why would we do anything that, other than just focus on the momentum and see what happens? Because Adrian's right, there will be bumps in the road, but if you don't gear everything towards where this is going over the course of the season, those bumps in the road just become kind of incidents. They don't become, well, this is a huge setback, because we know Arsenal teams of old, they've allowed those setbacks to hit them. But the one thing they've done brilliant this season is lose to Manchester United and then immediately go and win at Brentford, where they lost last season, and beat Tottenham at home.
A gauge of where Arsenal fans are at is probably what I was thinking yesterday when I was watching the Manchester derby. Who did I want to win? Did I want City to win to sort of knock Manchester United for the place in the top four, or did I want City to lose so that Arsenal had a better chance of winning the title? And I absolutely was leaning towards, I'm happier if City win this. And I think Arsenal fans are still in that place. I really do.
No, you've certainly got a big grin on your face, Adrian. Maybe another measure of Arsenal's new press, the fact that Conte decided with 20 minutes to go, and even though he was facing Arsenal, who have a history of blowing such leads, decided to simply withdraw all of his attacking players, apart from Harry Kane, with Eintracht Frankfurt coming up in the Champions League. Anyway, Arsenal, who have Bodo Glimt at home, not in the Arctic Circle, on Thursday, will be facing Liverpool next weekend in another of those acid tests of their expectations. We'll talk Liverpool next.
Hello, listener. Now, how would you like a nice fat slice of the Totally Football Show, but on your bookshelf / in your bathroom? Well, the good news is the all-new Totally Football book is available to order right now, and it's the place to read the finest football writing about where football is in 2022 from all of your favourites at Team Totally and The Athletic. We've got pieces by Daniel Storey, Carl Anker, Tom Williams and Katie Wyatt. James Horncastle has penned an emotional farewell to Giorgio Chiellini. Rafa Honigstein tells us about the thorny issue of Bayern Munich's relationship with Qatar. Duncan Alexander finds the most statistically average footballer in the Premier League, and it's all introduced by our very own James Richardson. There's also a day-by-day diary of last season, a comprehensive On This Day section, and of course, a big chunk of quiz questions so you can run your very own Inter Totally with all your friends or by yourself. The Totally Football book is edited by Nick Miller and it's out on October the 6th, but you can pre-order it now from everywhere that sells books. This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
March is wide. Here's Mitoma. Lallana left it. Welbeck missed it. But it's scored in the back by Leandro Trossard for his treble.
Liverpool 3, Brighton 3. Terrific stuff from the Seagulls in Roberto De Zerbi's first game in charge. As expected, his teams tend to score loads and concede loads. How much can we tell about what life's going to be like under their new manager from this single 90 minutes?
Well, Brighton are a really well-run club, so they will have gone for a manager who they think can continue the same principles as Graham Potter. On the evidence of this game, and it's obviously the smallest sample size possible, they might well be a little bit more chaotic doing it. Graham Potter's Brighton tried to control games, whereas Brighton seemed to almost deliberately pass up that control and play on this kind of high-wire chaos football, which is absolutely brilliant to watch and was the most effective way of getting at Liverpool, because as soon as they did kind of try and sit back on a lead a bit, they were punished. But I thought the most impressive thing from De Zerbi was the way he used those substitutes and kind of shifted the game in the last 20 minutes, because he brought on Mitoma, who has struggled for minutes so far this season, but Brighton fans are really, really excited about him. And he just drove at Trent Alexander-Arnold, which is exactly what they needed to do, because Alexander-Arnold is under pressure, was probably at fault for at least one of the goals, was a bit off for another of them. And Mitoma just drove at him and opened the game up again in Brighton's favour. There's such a belief about Brighton, which, given that they've just lost a long-term manager and one of the best managers in the country, could easily have been absent for a few weeks while they kind of, you know, Adrian will know more than me, but players in these situations kind of tend to sort of size up a manager, I think, in the first few weeks. But they don't seem to have done that. They've just gone, we're going to carry on doing what we do.
Took the two-goal lead at Anfield. Could have been a lot more. Liverpool came back to lead themselves 3-2 before Trossard, with his hat-trick goal, earned them a point. Interesting, you mentioned a trend there. It's even interesting, even with Andrew Robertson out at the moment, that it was Alexander-Arnold's flank that was being attacked, not just in this game, but other ones too. It's like managers didn't see Klopp explaining how Trent's a really good defender before the match.
Yeah, and we should say their next two league opponents are Arsenal, who targeted Tottenham's right flank on Saturday, and Manchester City, who targeted Manchester United's right flank on Sunday. So it's not going to get any easier.
And it wasn't just Trent Alexander-Arnold that struggled in this game. I think Van Dijk, you've got to look at his part in some of the goals as well. It was not pretty. I mean, for the leveller, I mean, he looked really stiff, stiffer than I was probably the last time I played five-a-side, which was exceptionally stiff. He just couldn't move his body, and that's a problem. I think he's been playing that way for a number of weeks now, Virgil van Dijk. So that's an issue for them. But yeah, we shouldn't take too much away from Brighton. Trossard is a really exciting player. Underrated. Great left foot hat-trick, wasn't it, from him? And what I admire most about Trossard is his ability to play pretty much anywhere. Because Potter used him as a wing-back on numerous occasions, didn't he? That was sort of allowed to roam here, there and everywhere. Here he was playing behind the main striker. He can play as a 10 out wide either side. Yeah, he's a good footballer.
Well, Brighton looking brilliant. If it's too early probably to draw too many conclusions from the first 90 minutes of De Zerbi's reign, can we, though, add some sums up about Liverpool? They're, what, 11 points behind Arsenal, 10 behind Man City. They do face both those teams in the next two rounds, and they do have a game in hand on both of them as well. But it doesn't look like this is a blip anymore.
No, it looks pretty unlikely that they can mount a title charge this season. I mean, we'll know more in the next couple of weeks, but you'd have to say with the issues they've got in several areas of the pitch, it looks unlikely that they're going to go on one of those Liverpool-esque, you know, 19 wins in 20. And equally, you can't see City dropping a huge amount of points between now and the rest of the season. So it looks really unlikely. I think issues in midfield, issues with certain goal scorers and issues in defence. It's too much to fix, I think.
And issues overall in their heads seem to be the message from Klopp and one or two of the players. Confidence.
Yeah, and that's the flip side to that, the Liverpool rise of, as Tim mentions, those 19 wins in 20 games. That can make you feel untouchable. It can also, when things start to go wrong, make you feel like you don't really know how to fix it. And I think if there's anything that stays true of Liverpool in the winning runs and the periods of poor form, it's that when one element of the team isn't working, it feels like that very quickly spreads to the rest of the team. And Klopp, you know, a very passionate defence of Trent Alexander-Arnold, and rightly so. But it almost became a kind of prosecution of the system, because he said the reason he's struggling is that we're asking him to press so high at the pitch and that press isn't really working, so therefore he's being exposed in defence. And that's exactly the point. If one thing isn't working, in the final third, it suddenly makes your right back struggle, which is a very difficult thing to fix because you're trying to fix sort of four or five things at once.
Yeah, well, Klopp's been here before, of course, in his seventh season at his previous sides. Is this one going to turn out different? We'll get more idea, as you say, in the next few weeks. So good start for De Zerbi anyway. Good start for Graham Potter too in his first Premier League match with a 2-1 victory at Palace. Although Palace and their owner, Steve Parish, rather upset that Thiago Silva wasn't sent off in this game for that deliberate handball. Adrian, you're nodding.
Oh, it's a very, very cynical piece of play. He was last man. The player might have been to the left of centre, but he was going to flick it around to the centre. He would have been through 1v1. It's a very, very obvious red card. And yes, Stuart Atwell it was on VAR, I believe. I think he's made a huge error there. And that was at 1-0 up, by the way. Crystal Palace were in front at that point in the game. So it was a really pivotal call. And if I was Steve Parish, if I was Patrick Vieira, I would have been fuming too.
Chelsea turning it round with goals from Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. And ooh, what a stunner from Conor Gallagher, former Eagle himself on loan.
Why didn't he celebrate? Adrian, I'm going to ask you this. You know, you're a young professional. Yeah. You've just scored a last minute winner, massive moment in your career, first goal for your club as well, I believe. And you're able to stand still, really?
I do get it. Yeah, I get why you think that is just so wrong. The thing is, you're talking to someone that the better the goal that I scored and I didn't score that many goals, to be perfectly honest. But the better the goal, my rule was always to dampen the celebration. Just play it down.
Like Ancelotti.
If you smank one in the top corner, it's like, yeah, I'm just going to stand there.
That's what I do.
And say, yeah, this is normal.
Turn your colour up, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. This is what happens. So I can actually see why Gallagher did it, but I know the point you're making. If ever there's an opportunity to go absolutely mental, it would have been there, wouldn't it?
Chelsea have Milan coming up on Wednesday in the Champions League. A Milan side who are just behind Napoli and Atalanta at the top of the Serie A standings, but coming to this game with all sorts of injuries. Mike Maignan, their brilliant goalkeepers, not available. Theo Hernandez, the marauding fullback as well, which given the way that they'll probably approach the game could be a big loss. But Rafa Leao, who's a bit of a Chelsea target himself, is fit and did score at the weekend in an extraordinary match. They went to rainy Empoli, only scored the first goal after 80 minutes, was stunned when Empoli then got an equaliser in the 91st, but still scored another two after that to win 3-1. Anyway, looking forward to that match on Wednesday. And others too. Mentioned that the Totally Football Show European edition will be out on kind of Tuesday lunchtime-ish. Looking back on what's happened at the weekend, but also forward to all the midweek action. There's some amazing matches in the Champions League. Also, Benfica against Paris Saint-Germain should be an absolute cracker. Inter taking on Barcelona. And perhaps the pick of the bunch might be Ajax against Napoli. Anyway, look forward to the thoughts of Rafa, Jules, James and Alvaro on Tuesday lunchtime. And while I'm plugging other podcasts, the Athletic Football Podcast, there's a special episode of that out right now with Carl Anker featuring in a panel discussing the impact of taking the knee in football and where the gesture goes from here. Well, next up on this Totally Football Show, we're going to be talking about managerial movements and more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
3rd of October, on this day in 2018, Steve Bruce sacked by Aston Villa, or one day after a Villa fan had thrown a cabbage at him. There's no coming back from a cabbage. On this day in 2022, Middlesbrough, in the bottom three of the Championship, have released their manager, Chris Wilder. It's a busy time for managers getting the hoof. Of course, we're going to get onto Wolves in a second. But Hull, in the Championship, also dispensed with their boss, Shota Arveladze. Curiously, they waited until almost the end of the international break to do it, just 8 hours before Hull took on Luton and had a pretty abject performance. Watford, meanwhile, who you will recall, did replace Rob Edwards with Slaven Bilic previously, were rewarded with a 4-0 win at Stoke. So well done, the Hornets. They scored more goals in that match away on Sunday than they had in their previous five away games under Rob Edwards. So, you know, who knows? Who knows? Anyway, Wolves parting company with Bruno Lage after their 2-0 defeat at West Ham on Saturday. Tim, was this a surprise to you?
No. Not at all. Fans have started to turn. They turned during the game on Saturday, which always tends to be a sign that something's coming. And then Ruben Neves came out after the game and said the players aren't training well enough or hard enough, which Bruno had no sort of defence for. So it's a shame for him. You know, I've spent a bit of time with him and he's a really nice guy and fairly devoid of ego, which is quite rare at the top level of football. But the problem for Bruno Lage is, you know, he's a tactical expert. He's written books on tactics. If you're coming in as a sort of a tactical specialist and you can't solve the goal scoring problem that Wolves have had, you know, 41 goals in 46 games since he took over. No team has scored fewer in that time.
Here's a quick stat on that, Tim. Adam Bate pointing out that they haven't just been outscored by every Premier League team this season. They've actually scored fewer Premier League goals since April than Burnley. And Burnley were relegated in May.
Yeah, and also Erling Haaland has as many hat-tricks this season as Wolves have goals.
What?
just the three so far. And then, also the fans, I mean, you know, they would sing his name, but they'd never truly warmed to him. I mean, Nuno was an impossible act to follow. You know, people were weeping at his last game. He was loved. You know, his face is still graffitied, you know, across the city. It was going to be hard to follow. And Bruno's a sort of a geeky PE teacher, very studious. So they were never going to warm to him as much as they did Nuno. And I guess that gives them less patience. But what, one win in 15 either side of the season break. Suggestions he's lost a few of the players in the dressing room. And they spent $100 million in the summer. After a couple of years of really tight spending, they spent a lot of money in the summer. So it was only going to go one way.
All right. Matt Davis-Adams predicting at the end of last season that Wolves would go down in this campaign. They are currently now in the bottom three. Who do we think's coming in then? Who do you anticipate? Is it going to be a Portuguese manager? I mean, immediately there was talk of Ruben Amorim of Sporting. Or of Julen Lopetegui as well, of Sevilla, who's set to depart that club. Well, I mean, has been set to depart for a while. What are you hearing?
They'd essentially appointed Lopetegui in 2016. He'd verbally agreed to become Fosun's first manager of the club when they bought the club and sacked Kenny Jackett. And he'd verbally agreed and was talking about transfers and everything. That's how far down the line it was. But then the Spain job came up, so he abandoned Wolves. But apparently they're still on good terms. Wolves played Sevilla a couple of years later, and it all seemed very cosy. Wolves got Walter Zenger instead, by the way. So you can see you've got the rough end of that deal. But yeah, you can Google Portuguese managers who belong to the Gestifute stable, and that's your shortlist, basically. That's what they've done with the last two. You know, Scott Sellers is their technical director. They have got heads of recruitment. They have got heads of scouting. You know, believe it or not, but it's Uncle George, as they call him in those parts, who normally makes the big decisions. And I don't really expect anything different this time around, despite Chris Wilder's, you know, late availability, and Sean Dyche as well. I just don't really see that happening.
Okay. Chris Wilder, who had been earmarked for the Bournemouth job, they had a 0-0 draw with Brentford. And Gary Neil perhaps thus reinforcing his claim to to stay on as the permanent replacement for Scott Barker there, unbeaten in four matches under his interim management. Brentford, meanwhile, in that game, keeping their first clean sheet in 20 Premier League away games. Daniel, you're probably itching to say, well done, West Ham, by the way, who did win that game against Wolves that saw Bruno Lage dismissed. They've moved up to 15th now. They're at Anderlecht on Thursday in the Europa League.
I'll be there.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Europa Conference League, I'm hearing.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I'll be there. I'm doing a lovely little midweek trip of Frankfurt, Spurs, Leipzig, Celtic and Anderlecht, West Ham. So,
That does sound nice.
I mean, West Ham, basically Bowen clicked, which helps. And just Declan Rice is just, he's a joy to watch. I know he's not, you know, people tend to obsess about sort of attacking skillful players at the moment, but I think he's probably my favourite player to watch in the Premier League at the moment, Declan Rice. Just the way he has to do everything in that team of like winning the ball, but then also driving forward and playing kind of progressive passes and creating chances. He's doing absolutely everything, and he's able to do absolutely everything, which I suspect West Ham would be better off trying to slightly mitigate some of his work, given the schedule he's got for the next 7 or 8 months. But he's just in fantastic form at club level.
Yeah, I did co-coms on this game, and I didn't actually think West Ham were very good. I thought that they were needlessly defensive as well, sort of just inviting so much pressure from Wolves. I mean, it was almost banter, wasn't it? Because they were saying, well, you're never going to score anyway, so we'll retreat, we'll defend on the edge of our own box, and we'll just pick you off.
That was the team talk, was it? Written on the tactics board? Banter it
what
up
about
today,
Diego lads. Costa, Adrian?
He looked good. I got to say, I thought he looked the part. Obviously, he only came on for, I think, around half an hour. But he looked sharp. He looked like he cared. He was sort of trying to boss everybody around. He had a real presence up top. And I think Wolves did look better when he was on there. He missed a good chance when Traore, another player that you think, how can he not get in this team? So dropped his shoulder, went to the byline for about the 20th time, and he actually found a good cross this time. And it was a free header, and you would have expected him to score. But yeah, he could be a really key player for them in the weeks to come. It's just can he last 90 minutes, I guess. At the other end of the pitch, I thought Scamacca was the best player. I thought he was outstanding. A great goal. And he's a proper number nine that can hold it and not just score close range goals either, not just about headers. He can smack them in the top bins, and that's what he did here in this game. He did Scamacca it for Sassuolo a few times. Scamacca can smack it, that is for sure.
Just to say on Wolves' strikers, because I feel like Bruno Lage does deserve a little bit of a defence here, because obviously he'll be listening as well, they haven't scored goals, but last season Raul Jimenez just wasn't the same player, you know, unfortunately, since his fractured skull. So they spent £15 million on Kaladzic, who has got a horrendous injury record, and lo and behold does his ACL in his first game, and then gets Diego Costa, who, you know, I agree with Adrian, has got something to offer, certainly as a focal point, if not a goal scorer, but he's come out of semi-retirement basically, you know, he's not played this year. So, you know, Lage is trying to build a team around a striker, and he hasn't really had one. And also, you know, so that they started the game without a striker on Saturday. They also started the game with one centre-half because Nathan Collins is suspended, and Wolves, you know, and this isn't Lage's fault, they've got rid of Connor Cody on loan to Everton, which looks stupider by the week. They've sold Willy Bolly to Forest, and they've sold Dendonka to Villa. That's three centre-halves, you know, willingly given to other Premier League clubs, and all it takes is one suspension for Ruben Neves to be playing at centre half.
Right. So, but was that not Bruno Lage's doing though?
He has some say in recruitment, but not the final say. And he said publicly, you know, I need more defenders, but he didn't get them.
The Cody one is fascinating to a non Wolves fan, because effectively Lage wanted to move to a back four. Correct me if I'm wrong here, Tim, but Lage had this idea to move to a back four and didn't really think that Cody was capable of playing in that, or certainly not suited to that. And because Cody had so much goodwill, they thought, well, we'll let you go on loan to Everton, which, as you say, now looks a huge gamble. And lo and behold, Cody's now playing in a back four for Everton and looking absolutely fine, and Wolves played with a back three on on Saturday.
No, absolutely. It looks ridiculous, but also there's a man management point of view there, because that was said to be Lars's weakness when he joined. His man management's not great, and he doesn't really talk to the players very much, you know. Doesn't really have one-on-one sort of meetings with them, or doesn't tell them while they're out the team. It's not really his strength. But then you've got Connor Cody basically ran the dressing room, probably one of the most impressive captains or people I've ever met, to be honest. He's an unbelievable leader. So to let him go, like you say, it looks ridiculous, but a master stroke for Everton.
Wolves with some large shoes to fill then Connor Cody at Everton, now at the heart of the number one defence in the Premier League. This following their come from behind victory at St Mary's this weekend, they moved up to 11th place. Frank Lampard's Toffees. Back-to-back wins for Everton. They're on a 7-game unbeaten run in all competitions. Only conceded 7 goals. As I say, come from behind at St Mary's. That's the sort of place you go to if you need a come from behind win, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah. Southampton are kind of trapped in this shame spiral this season, in that they spent all their money on teenagers. And then, because you have to have faith in teenagers and kind of patience with them, Hasenhüttl has come under pressure for not picking them and leaving them on the bench. So on Saturday, he picked 7 of them in the starting 11, and then they made mistakes. And he said after the game, well, that's the thing with young players. They make mistakes, but they're better than the players who have already got here. So, either something's gone badly wrong there, where he wasn't on board with buying almost predominantly players aged between 18 and 21, and I suspect this is the reality, is that he's not going to be there very long.
Wow. Well, sometimes you do need to be punched in the face to learn something.
I'm not queuing up for that theory, by the way.
They're dangerously close to the bottom three at the moment. Only 1 point clear down in 16th place. Adrian?
Yeah, on Pickford. He's been punched in the face a few times, hasn't he? He's had a few clips around the ear.
Well, he's improved, hasn't he?
He's suffered, hasn't he, Jordan Pickford? And he's come through it. I think he's been one of the most impressive players in the division actually this season, character wise, because a little bit like Granit Xhaka, he's come back from a position where people were questioning him, not quite as much as Xhaka, but I think he's playing better than ever. You look at Opta's prevented goals stats, and he is sitting on top of the pile. He's saved 2.4 goals that Everton should have conceded. So he's the most influential keeper in the Premier League right now.
Also, we should say on Everton's back two, it was Cody on loan and Tarkowski on a free. And they've got the league's best defence. That's pretty good.
They've also nailed it, because they've got players who probably are very good but probably won't go to the World Cup, which means the team is kind of full of those players. Dominic Calvert-Lewin won't go, can get himself fit. Demarai Gray won't go. They've got Anthony Gordon won't go. All of their important players probably won't go to the World Cup, which is really helpful this season.
Wow. Interesting times ahead then, perhaps, for Everton. Also this weekend, there was a 0-0 at Elland Road, much to Jesse Marsh's displeasure, as his 10-man Leeds finished 0-0 with Aston Villa. And loads of goals, meanwhile, at Craven Cottage, where Newcastle were 4-1 winners against 10-man Fulham. That was after Nathaniel Shalabar's red card, only 8 minutes into the game. Holy cow, that Almiron goal. Yeah.
Was it just me that I got a little bit of Di Canio vibes out of it? I know it wasn't a scissor kick, but it was the sort of angle of the volley. To take it on his left foot there from the angle of the pass, I thought was astonishing. And it genuinely was a thing of beauty, wasn't it? The way that he connected with the ball and it went into that far top corner. That was one of my favourite goals of the season, for sure. It'll be in the mix for goal of the season, I would imagine.
Should Almiron be in the mix for, you were talking about most improved players? It does seem like he's really finding a whole new level of efficacy.
He needed to, didn't he? Yeah,
well, that's
because
true.
I think he had 13 combined goals and assists before Saturday over 3 years at Newcastle. He's a really hard-working player. He's really popular in the dressing room. He's a real kind of live wire character. They love him there, but he just didn't have that kind of goal contributions that managers need. And with Alexander Isak coming in, I think there was probably a chance that Isak could play off the right and Callum Wilson play centrally. But you wouldn't drop Almiron now. I think he also is one of those that Newcastle struggle to keep everybody fit. So they struggle to get Bruno and Saint-Maximin and Almiron and a central striker, be it Wilson or Isak, all fit at the same time. And I think Almiron's one of those players that when everyone else is kind of hogging possession a little bit, he's a really good surprise option on the other side. And that the key is to be, you know, become more consistent doing that, because they signed him because he was incredibly talented and he was kind of tearing up
league MVP
MLS.
He was tearing up MLS
and the scouting reports of him were incredibly high, and Newcastle were really grateful that they managed to get him, and he's just not quite kicked on. But yeah, as you say, as Adrian says, that goal is a superb piece of technical ability, and he can do that.
Excellent. Fulham still eighth, by the way, despite that defeat. However, worrying scenes as both Kurzawa and Alexander Mitrovic limped off in this game. Don't know yet how serious that injury is to Mitrovic. All right. Do you want to say anything about Leeds nil, Aston Villa, a snail-paced match?
Can I say something about Jesse Marsh? I feel like I'm always having a pop at him every time I come on this show. But... the guy is too emotional, in my opinion.
Don't you want that?
Fans want him, I think, to a degree. But is it good for the team? Leeds is a pretty combustible sort of atmosphere anyway, isn't it? And I think that because he's so emotional and he wears his heart on his sleeve so much, and he got wound up here. He got incredibly wound up here by Steven Gerrard's tactics, which I think is great from Stevie G, by the way. Because he went to frustrate Leeds. He knew that by slowing the game down, it would wind up the manager, it would wind up the players, it would wind up the crowd, and it would make it a different type of match. That is smart management, and others will definitely copy what Steven Gerrard did in this game, not least because Jesse Marsh spent the press conference and the interviews afterwards bemoaning the fact that they were time-wasting and they were killing the game. So I just think he's too much of an open book. And if you have a manager like that, it will wind the players up. And if players are wound up, their discipline will go at times. And I think it's safe to say that Sinisterra's discipline went in this game, and he's not the only one this season.
All right, then. Well, still to come is the third part of Tim Spears' cross-town or cross-regional rivalry triumvirate. When you'll be attending, is it Leicester City, Nottingham Forest, or Forest, Leicester City, Tim?
It's Leicester, Nottingham Forest.
Are there trains available?
I'm driving across from my hotel in Manchester shortly. But is it a proper derby? That's the question I'll be asking myself throughout the evening. Someone's shaking their head here.
I mean, I can be incredibly inflammatory and say it is to Leicester. Because of the geography, is that their closest club is probably Coventry, just about, which isn't a rivalry. So it is to Leicester, but obviously Forest have Derby. So it's a kind of, I mean, your piece will be fabulous without needing my input, Tim, but it's a weird game. In recent years, it's felt quite nasty in a way that the Derby game is Derby. So it's kind of built up beyond all recognition and everyone feels sick on match day, and fans certainly don't drink in the sunshine laughing before the game. Whereas Leicester has got this kind of nasty element now. I mean, before the FA Cup game last season, Nottingham Town Centre got smashed up, and it feels like it's an excuse for nastiness and snideness rather than a big derby in a sporting context, I think.
All right, well, I hope we don't have any of that kind of thing this time around. And Tim, that you have an enjoyable trip to the King Power. When's your piece out?
It'll be out on Tuesday.
Oh, nice. Daniel, anything else you'd like to mention?
Yeah, I spent a few days in Denmark last week at FC Nordjylland, speaking to anyone and everyone there, from sort of CEO down to players and coaches. The headline is that they've got the youngest football team in the world. That's the kind of big sell. They've got an average age of 21 and a half in their first team. And they've got this relationship with Right to Dream Academy, who are now the co-owners of the club. So just a fascinating football club. They're basically, they do care about the league position, but their whole driver is just to bring through young players and then sell them on. And they've sold Mohamed Kudus to Ajax, who's the kind of current poster boy, but also Mikael Damsgaard, who's now at Brentford. And it's an incredible operation, just watching a team train where the average age is 20 or 21.
Mm. Wow, brilliant. Many thanks. Adrian, anything you want to plug since we're all plugging stuff?
Absolutely, yeah. What the EFL is, it will be later today. Lots and lots of sackings to discuss. That's kind of what the show's been centred around in recent weeks. But yeah, it's good fun with me, Matt Davis-Adams and Sam Parkin.
Boom. Excellent. Well, look forward to all of that. Allow me to mention again that Toby Football Show European Edition will be with you Tuesday lunchtime. That's it for today's edition of the show. Many thanks for joining us. Adrian, Daniel, Tim, producer Charlie, and you, listener, have a great time. We'll catch up with you soon.
You've been listening to the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally.
The Athletic.